have the ground game. We've actually built the practices that people aspire to create.
History will prove one of us correct.
Wait. You're not letting me finish, bro.
This is how you become bulletproof. Bulletproof. Bulletproof.
And this is a good episode. Craig is actually grinding it out on ski slopes or on a snowboard right now. So it's a good day for him to be missing. And the reason being is because, you know, we get some friction on, you know, sometimes we sweep with broad brush strokes and we get some friction sometimes for getting in the weeds of the granularity of things. But today, due to his absence, we are going to get into it. And we're going to go over something, guys, that we're going to start high level and go down. And I wish that I got to tell you, I wish I had heard someone tell me what we're about to kind of do, even just discuss it when I did my first acquisition. So we're going to talk about how do you do an acquisition? How do you do kind of a startup? I think the templates are very, very similar, but how do you basically expand? And then what are the things that need to be in your purview as you kind of look forward? Because as we all know, Dwight, Trey, who you're both in the middle, I think, of acquisitions. I just finished one. As we all know, the work doesn't start. The work starts long before the negotiations, the deal, all that things, right? There's site selection. There's how am I going to do this? There's your contingencies. There's your financing. There's your demographic reports. There's all these things that you want to look at prior to getting into an LOI and an MOU and things like that. And we're going to break it down. Okay. So I think we should spend, let's max this out at 5 minutes. We're going to talk about real quickly, because I think we've beat this over the 350 episodes. I think we've beat this down. Acquisition versus a startup. Yeah. Can you guys succinctly tell at this point in your career, which one would drive the other behavior? Meaning are both on the table? And which one would drive the other behavior? Trey?
Both are absolutely on the table, but acquisitions drive the behavior of startups.
I focus on acquisitions
for a few reasons that are paramount. One is cash flow, first and foremost. Day one, I have cash flow.
Got it.
Secondly, debt to revenue. That ratio is something that banks will use to continue opening the doors to giving you capital.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit, Trey?
I can. So if I buy a practice at $1 million, it's doing $1 million in revenue and I pay $650,000 for it, then I have a 65% debt to ratio to revenue ratio.
Okay.
That ratio is always part, in some form, is always part of covenants from a bank, and staying in a certain ratio always is appealing to banks to be able to loan more money, not to mention comfort for you because you're not over levered. So everybody's number is different and the numbers, they're going to change over time, but debt to revenue is always better when you're buying revenue.
So a lending runway essentially is what you're saying, right?
Exactly.
Let me ask you something on that, Trey, not to get too granular too fast, but is there is there a scenario where you can actually increase your runway by actually adding an acquisition day one?
Of course.
Okay.
Value buys.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. Very interesting. Okay. So Dwight, same question. If you were to look at acquisition, just draw the distinction, because I actually get this question a lot, guys. Still, should I acquire one or should I do a startup? I'm like, need more information. But anyway, Dwight, can you quickly distill at your place in time why and where and how?
So generally speaking, especially on the first few acquisitions for lending, if you want to get lending down to where you're putting no money down and they're going to get full amount of lending, for example, banks are going to see that a business is up and running and has cash flow. And so that's the easiest component. Startups tend to require you to put money down to take that on, or mm-hmm. that they're going to lend against the value of your current existing assets. So normally organizations don't do startups until they've got enough and they can cash flow it themselves, because yep. there's no bank of patience, no bank of cash, and none of it coming along that's already just consistent AR that we know that's coming. So that's why it tends to be easier to build the foundation of an enterprise on acquisitions and then later do startups. So for example, like Heartland that has always done acquisitions now is earmarked to do over 100 startups in, you know, this year, right? So that kind of mindset is that's where they're at and they can capture it.
Okay. I would break it down. I'd love that. I think we're all saying the same thing. If you want to quote unquote buy revenues, right? If you want to buy, there's less risk potentially in an acquisition, right? It's a proven model. It's been there in effect for X number of years. There's some existential threats that happen with acquisition, as we all know. We'll get into that a little bit. But if you're not, you know, if you're in a scenario where you potentially don't need to bolt on more revenues for whatever reason, and you're okay with something being an investment over time, then acquisitions are actually much cheaper. I'm sorry. Startups are actually much cheaper in the beginning than an acquisition, right? Meaning you can probably build an office if you lease a space, 250. I think the quote is probably 250 to 375 now for like a, maybe a 4 or 5 unit operatory. Practice. Maybe I'm off on my numbers a little bit, but that was kind of some numbers thrown around by a DSO that we all know, actually one in Texas. So that's an easy step and repeat. They have a system, they know their thing, they onboard the doctor, they open up these stores and they go from there. Right? When you buy a practice, you're actually paying for the goodwill cash flow of the aggregate of the business revenues, right? Over time. Okay, so we've set a pin in that a little bit. The other kicker I will say is sometimes actually acquisitions, if there's a new emerging area, I should say, where you know there's certain growth, meaning if you have boots on the ground knowledge and you know there's certain growth into a different area, like it's all heading north, so to speak. Let's just say hypothetically you're in a town, then an acquisition might be off the table because something might not exist that you like in that Correct. Domain, yeah. Right? Yep. And Dwight, I think you actually did some startups because of that very reason, right? You saw the growth coming. Okay. Yep. So it's not that I guess what I'm trying to say, guys, and then I'll shut up, is that I think true dental entrepreneurs don't pick, they're not a one trick pony. It's not, I only do acquisitions or I only do startups. I think the true dental entrepreneur is someone like you two who are like, I'm agnostic to the process, just show me the deal, right? Show me where I can Absolutely. Lever my time and money in the best position Absolutely. On a go forward basis. Okay.
I think that's really powerful to note because like right now I'm doing acquisition, but then I'm doing this essentially a flex, like taking on a space that was a dental office, potentially is kind of exiting. In fact, Trey pointed it out to me and we're looking at it, but it's close enough to another organization and there's a chunk of my team that's going to go there and it's going to be essentially what we call a startup quote, because it has no basis to it. Also, a lot of people call startups de novo. So I just want to throw that out there to make sure.
Well, it has no patient base to it, you're saying?
No patient base.
Yeah, yeah. So therefore, it's a startup.
That practice has relocated. Therefore, it's considered a startup.
Got it.
But it makes sense from the sake of the deal, from the brand marketing, from all of it in the general area. So.
Yeah. What I was saying at the beginning that now, Pete, you've touched on is, and Dwight, what you said as well, the acquisitions drive the startups. And by that, what I mean is my base is built on acquisitions, but I actually would prefer a startup,
of course,
but I don't want to be negative in cash flow. So as long as my acquisitions and my existing organization can cover the cash flow deficit, then I'm going to keep doing startups at whatever rate I can.
Yeah. It's a hybrid model, right? Like,
correct.
Yeah. 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 And I think that's where things evolve. And I think I'm in the same position. Like I love a startup. I think you get a clean canvas is really cool and neat, provided you have a thoroughbred team and you know your integration and you have your SOPs down, you know, you have your flagship. I think it's exciting. And if you have the buffer room in your income to take over a down year in this startup, right? I think allowing for a 12-month I'm going to make no money to negative money to no money on this startup is very, very sound.
Let me explain that because I had somebody ask me this a couple weeks ago and we got to this level. And I was like, you have to understand, as you build a business, the whole goal is that you're paying yourself what you want to pay yourself, but you've got these distributions of excess profits that are coming out. And those of us who are entrepreneur are not only getting that and putting that, some of that in our pockets, some of that's just going to reinvest into the business and growing the business, which means you can do a startup or a de novo practice and you can start it by paying 250 and 300 grand. And if you've proven the model and your team can consistently build that model of what it means, you might have $1 million practice in a short windfall without a lot of debt that you carry, which is why we would all pick the startup if we could.
Yeah, I'll take being equal, right?
But it has to come from somewhere. And in, you know, depending on how aggressive or how quick you're trying to build these, the cash is coming from certain distributions or excess profits of other practices to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically just wanted to make sure we got real.
Yeah, it's a temporary rob Peter to pay Paul kind of thing, right? Yeah. And hopefully it's temporary. And if it's not, then you know there could be either your diligence, which we're going to get into here in just a second. Your diligence was faulty. Your systems were faulty. Your marketing was faulty. Your team culture, like there's a lot of things that you could start pointing the finger about, like, oh, this didn't work. God, there's so many things, right? So, okay, we took care of the age-old question. I have a little cheat sheet here for me. Okay, so let's focus on acquisitions for just a second. Actually, we're going to focus on acquisitions the rest of the time because really there's nothing else in us from a startup land that I think is pertinent to what we're going to do. Because I want to focus on basically how to identify them, right? I want to identify what are some of the pitfalls and dangers. I want to identify what an MOU or an LOI is. I want to identify some diligence. And then I also want to identify things you want to do before closing and things you want to do post-closing. And I know that just sounded like it's going to be a 12-hour podcast. We'll try to keep it pithy. But let's go to my cheat sheet on number two. How would you guys identify an acquisition? How does it jump up onto your radar?
Are you talking pipeline?
Pipeline. Well, okay. First, how are you sourcing? Yes. Are you going and talking to people? Or are you relying on brokers? What is your pipeline?
So my pipeline is basically a very large network of contacts and relationships that I maintain. And I put out there with all of them exactly what I'm looking for.
Okay.
That gets sourced from some from brokers, although not as many. Some I cold call if they practice in a one
How's
of my role practices.
So, yeah. I'm curious about that, Trey, because I had that on my list of things to do for about 7 years now. And it seems to never get done because it's sweaty back to me. So tell me how that goes.
So the third practice I had was a cold call.
Let's try this. Hello, this is Dr. Green's office. How can I help you?
I've done this. I know exactly.
Hi, this is Dr. Tippett. Is Dr. Green available?
He's with a patient right now. Can I leave a message?
Absolutely. Could you give him my number? I just wanted to meet with him. We'd love to take him to lunch at some point in time.
It's just like that, huh?
It's that easy.
The same way.
They call back. We take him to lunch. We start talking about it. Although on the phone, you already have a conversation about what's happened, what's brought us to this point, why we're doing it. And the first one was actually pretty easy for me because he had already engaged a broker and it was random. So he freaked out, small town. He thought that someone had spilled the beans.
No way.
Small town. Now he's worried. But it's not nearly as sweaty back as it seems.
Sell to me or I'll tell everybody. I'm just kidding. Yeah. I'm just kidding.
Your secret's out.
Okay. All right. So pipeline, Dwight.
Yeah. For me, I would say it's more consistently brokers that bring deals mm-hmm. to me. It's usually Same. Just the easiest method and more consistent, mostly because they also know what I'm fishing for. Right. And I think that really, really helps. Back in the day, I would have bought all kinds of stuff. These days, it's like if it's not hitting 800 grand or something.
Dwight, I'm going to stay with you. Okay. Go. Since now you've got someone, a broker, and he's saying, hey, Dr. Dwight, I've got the perfect thing for you. Let me send you the data room. Right. In the data room, well, Let me send you all the documents, right? Which is essentially a data private equity name for data room, which is all the finances, all the payroll, all the contracts, all the things. I'm going to send you it all, Dwight. Where does Dwight Pecora go when he opens up that email and he opens up that chart? Where does Dwight go immediately to look at? What's your first thing that you go to look at? And this isn't going to be the only thing, so don't feel, but where do you go? Where's the second place you go? First, you're going to go to the P&L and be like, what do they make? Right? Probably.
That's the first. Yeah.
Yeah.
First
okay. Thing so what's you the second thing you're going
to
do?
To see if it's in something that you want. Because practice is what I mean by that is practices sometimes can be so low. It's more of a burden to add them and buckle onto your organization and try and grow them.
I would say, Dwight, they are the most burdensome.
Yeah. Oh, by far.
Yeah. Exhausting. With the least upside.
Yeah, much easier to do a startup. Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you go to revenue, then you go to where I'm trying to go to, Dwight, is because you are a KPI master, right? And you know how to look for things that that mere mortals can't see. And so is there something you go to look to identify, A, it's not a loser practice, it's just underperforming?
Well, for me, it's the true profit and loss statement, if that's what you're asking. You're asking okay. for a specific one because the idea is it was all arbitrage. So top to bottom, like okay. what's the number that I know that I'm going to hit?
Explain. I know we've talked about arbitrage a lot, but sure. even to someone like you're not, you sure. don't run a DSO, you run a private DSO. So explain right. arbitrage even at your level, please.
So first off, high level arbitrage means a practice may be bought at a 4 or 5 times multiple of EBITDA on its own. And the second it's in my organization, it may be worth a 7, 8, 9 times multiple. So that's high level. Lower level, which is really where I get excited, is I look at that profit and loss statement and I see they're spending 9% on labs. Mm-hmm. I know I can get that down to
your internal arbitrage. There you go.
Yes.
Or economies of scale, I guess supplies. That would technically be, right?
Correct. Because I have built a model that I know I can consistently do in multiple locations. And therefore, I know that this group is spending this much on this. I can immediately make the cash flow make sense.
So Dwight, let me decipher what you're saying. I'm going to play the moderator here of saying like, so you go, hey, look at the revenues. Okay, great. They're this, they're probably at, and you run your own kind of EBITDA. You look at the P&L quickly, give your own calculations. Okay, cool. I have enough arbitrage for me to make it worth it. Then you go and you say, man, the supplies were 7.5%. I know at my scale, it's very easy to drop that 2.5. Great. So you have additional arbitrage, not just enterprise arbitrage mm-hmm. of I bought for 4 and in my ecosystem, no. it's 7. Yeah. You have internal economies of scale arbitrage of saying, I know I can drive these through my cost savings, through my lab negotiations, through my KOL
yes.
discounts, whatever it is.
So the vast majority of the time, that big picture arbitrage of the multiple of EBITDA is irrelevant because it doesn't cash flow the business for me. I like to get to where all the debt that's paid on a monthly basis is managed by me on the internal
arbitrage. Say that again. Yeah. Say this again, Dwight.
So there's no
cash flow and EBITDA are not the same, right?
Correct. There's You're no right. cash flow benefit to me bringing in a practice. It's now worth more. It's only worth more if I'm selling my whole enterprise.
Amen.
So it doesn't yep. matter really. That arbitrage is irrelevant to me in the grander scheme of what's going
well,
on.
Well, it's irrelevant.
Now it's irrelevant.
It's,
now
it's accretive to the net worth of the of your organization, right? I don't think it's irrelevant. I think you're right. It's irrelevant for your consideration. I still
and
think it is
more runway.
It's relevant, but it's never realized
until an exit. Correct. Okay.
So
correct.
I'm Fair. Only talking about actualized benefit arbitrage day one, and my hope is that I can reduce those percentages on that P&L so significantly that it will cover the debt that it will cost for me to buy for this thing. And that's that's notoriously where Dwight's brain goes.
Wait, so you're basically say, does my cash flow cover my debt service? Yeah. Step one. Mm-hmm.
Dwight, to sum up Dwight's number one, seems to be a great
spaghetti
if I'm
words
wrong. He goes to a P&L and he looks to maximize the economies of scale that he can bring to the deal to then increase cash flow. He's looking for the win in that regard. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. But then there's, yeah. So there's enterprise arbitrage. He knows that, yes, we're going to bolt this on one day, right? It's going to get better, stronger, faster with me. And therefore, it's also going to be worth more, you know, just inherently by being itself. It's going to be worth more with me in control. And then B, I'm going to increase the operational efficiencies. Right. Yeah. You're going to drive top line and you're going to decrease, you're going to decrease expenditures, expenditures, and you're going to drive top line.
Yeah. Cause that's the most predictable of all. I know I then have an integration team who then
scale Dwight, operations. Do you feel, take a mid-level DSO. Yeah. Okay. This is going to be a comment bringing a knife to a gunfight. Do you feel you can function as competitively as a mid-level DSO?
Function right now? I'm pretty close.
From savings, from execution. We know that you have more of a boots on the ground SOP, right? You know how to run a practice, right? You're not from outside of dentistry trying to figure out how dentistry works. You know, you live and breathe it, right? So we know that. But do you think you can exercise the same cost savings, exercise the same relationships of, for example, lab, insurance, things like that?
I think in certain categories I've gotten to that level, but not in all. Not yet. I mean, because every practice I bolt on, I have somebody else's head that pops up and says, hey, by the way, you should pay less for this and this and this.
Interesting.
So it's like,
it's always driving forward.
It's always gotten better and better every time I added something.
That is a little tangential. I'm just, you know, we just had our office hours and I said that quote, you know, we were talking about supplies and like how many people just don't even question anything. They're just paying for supplies at rack rate, and they've had this relationship for 10 years with the supply manager, and they show up and whatever, and there's never been a negotiation, there's never been a question of pricing. It's just, yeah, that's what it is.
It is what it is.
And I'm saying, and I, and my comment was like, guess what, the future of dentistry is not that, because these DSOs are exposing how much meat is on the bone. Hey docs, how many times have you gone to a meeting only to come home to be served with a bunch of friction on all the things that you learned, right? The team didn't participate in the education that you got, therefore now you're coming home and the team is saying, hey, just give them till Thursday, it'll go away. So why not flip that on its head, right? Why don't you bring your team to the Bulletproof Summit? It's going to be in June 14th and 15th, where you're going to learn and innovate with your team. You're going to create massive alignment, and I promise you it's where the rubber is going to meet the road. So join us again, bulletproofsummit.com, and we'll see you this summer.
They are, but when you said boots on the ground, which is, let's define that a little better, because that's a big equalizer. A smaller private DSO of our size, for example, the three of us, can compete in a big way of operational efficiency, not so much in economies of scale of cost, because if you come and compete with me in a local Houston area, it's really hard to pull a doctor from me or win a doctor that goes there instead of me or whatever, because we are here. And that creates a boots on the ground operational efficiency that is really good. If someone's in Colorado and they're trying to hire from afar, that's not easy to do.
Good luck, right? Yeah.
To us, Houston, Atlanta, any of these. So that creates, and let's use supplies as an example. Let's say you're at 7% in supplies and a DSO is in 3%. It's a 4% delta. You can't go to zero, but that 4% delta can be easily made up for operational efficiencies. So you can compete for sure, just in different ways.
Interesting.
That's a good way to think about it.
That really is, Trey. That's a very, I think equalizer is a great term. Because Dwight, you're right. You may not have the same prowess when it comes to, you may not have a head of procurement, so to speak. Yeah. Maybe you do. Right. You know, but you have, like Trey said, you have certain advantages where it's boots on the ground, reputation, culture, all these things that are attractants and retaining components versus renting the rental car, right?
That's correct.
You got
okay.
It.
So Dwight, I'm going to stay with you for just a sec. What would you look at to identify an underperforming practice that has potential? What do you look at? What kind of metrics? What are you running your own thing to say? You don't have time. You don't have time to run 100. Okay. But you have time to quickly
pick one.
Yep. Well, you one or two. Yeah.
You mean the type of dentistry that's being done?
Could be.
No. I'm saying, like, look, you've identified that. All right, cool. There's this practice is running at 33% hygiene, right?
Sure.
I want to see how
the hygiene recall is going on or things.
Okay. Like I'm asking you, what are you going to look at, right? You have limited amounts of time with, as you're scanning these deals, what else are you going to do?
So for me, it has more to do with efficiencies of the actual practice. So we've gone through all our main KPI components. So there's a utilization rate, which is what I like to run at, to get an idea of how many chairs per hour that practice is actually running. And so what I like to do is I like to look to see if their utilization rate. So the way that's calculated is total amount of production divided by the number of hours times the number of chairs that those chairs are actually running. That gives me a sense of actual utilization.
So chairs times hours divided by the collection of those certain in that certain time period. Is that accurate?
So it's the total amount of production divided by the amount of chairs times the hours.
Yep.
So all that is, so it's the total number of hours that okay. single chair and that whole practice has available to see patients.
And that's utilization rate per hour, correct?
That's utilization rate per chair per hour, all organized under one sense of this is what that practice looks like.
And it's blending hygiene and operative practices.
The whole practice.
Okay. So it gives you a quick overview of
big picture.
Hey, what are you guys doing with the efficiency of this practice?
And usually if that utilization rate is under 125, I'm not touching it. I'm moving on.
Oh, there's because there's too bad. You're too saying that there's yeah. too low. Lower is yeah. not better.
Correct.
Yeah.
If it's over 150 to one, you know, between 125 and 175, beautiful. I can take mm-hmm. that, turn it into 250.
What if you see 500?
It's already juiced is the point. I would only buckle it on if I felt like I needed more runway for some reason because I'm growing the total enterprise, but it's going to be too expensive and it's too juiced and there's not a lot of arbitrage in that except for the decrease in costs and supplies.
Yeah. So it would have to be a perfect match.
Yeah. It would have to be an absolute perfect match.
So there's a Goldilocks scenario for you, Dwight.
Always.
Okay. All right.
My team pre-runs, like when the brokers contact us, the team runs utilization rates before I even look at the practice. Like I don't even get involved because if not, it's just, I can get emotional about stuff. You know, and I'm the guy who can go to, you know, Starbucks and be like, you're awesome. I hired you. You know, you're so good at serving me my coffee. You're hired at this company. I just get emotional about stuff. So I've had to remove myself from that and say, run the data, make it worth the analysis and go from there.
Okay. Would you stop? Let's just say it's 100 or is that a non-starter going forward? Is that a, hey, thanks for bringing this to me, not for me?
I had someone on my team bring me like a 115 and it was under our 125. And I would go as far as 120, but then I have to then take a look deeper and say, well, they're way overspending on all this other stuff. It's close to other portions of my enterprise. Therefore, I think I can train them up. They're not doing any specialty services or any expanded, you know, duties of hygiene.
So you felt like it was in the margin of error for just quick little, like, hey, let me fix this. So it falls into my range.
And that 100 to 125 is when I just take a slightly deeper look and I say, hey, what could we do? And if it's mostly that somebody just, because the problem I have there is usually it's a doctor replacement. And that means, what am I paying for? Because a lot of the patients are going to go away. A lot of the team's going to go away. It's a complete flush down the toilet and a reset. And so I'm not really interested in dealing with that as much.
Okay. Trey, same question. Obviously, you reserve the right to be able to say that's what I do too. I don't want to think that we have to be unique, you know, in our approach. But I'd love to hear your data.
You're in luck. Yeah. I do not at all do that.
Yeah. Okay.
So I look at one thing, and that's body count. I determine my purchase on body count, and that determines my price. That determines what
I'm willing to pay. That's how I determine my wife, too, by the way.
But yeah, it is. Absolutely. Just in different form of numbers. I like you. You'll do.
No. In this case, less was better.
Less. Yeah. Yeah. Get on the scale and make
No. I'm not talking that way. The body count. Okay. No, not the body count that way.
Let it beat it.
What's just that movie where he's talking about? Yeah. Just get on the scale. Make the number low. I'm not telling you to lose weight.
We had such respect from people until I just had to go to, you know, I put my mind in the gutter. Had to go there. Yeah. Like a locker room.
You're a bad person, but you're lucky that you're in good company with this the saints of Dwight and I. This is true.
Pull me back up, gentlemen.
We pull you back into the clouds.
Pull me back in. All right,
so body count is, and I'll give you an example of the acquisition I'm doing right now. I saw the acquisition. I was somewhat familiar with the practice. I know that there's a struggling management aspect of it. I immediately go to body count that I have to verify. And when I look at body count, I have a pretty good idea of what I can do with the practice. And that delta is an immediate debt to revenue win for me. And I am not concerned with what that practice is doing currently. Obviously, I look at the things Dwight does, but I do that much farther down the road. I go into the body count and think, is this enough people to where I can step in and just drive this forward?
Okay. You need to define body count fully for everybody.
Active patient count within 18 months is what I use.
And it's always full of shit when you're getting it from a broker, just so we know.
100%. That's for sure. So I verify it.
What's the number you look for?
Yeah, what is your body count, Trey?
I don't have a threshold because I don't have a 125 like Dwight using it. I look at it and go, what can I do with it? So if the body count is excessive and there's disorganization in terms of facility constraints or capacity, I start looking at it a different way as opposed to the body count's excessive and there's plenty of room to grow.
Yeah, but there's a point of diminishing returns on the low end, right? Where you're going to think like, is this juice worth the squeeze?
Not necessarily.
No? Okay.
So I do like the one, you know, and I'm not going to, I don't use utilization capacity like Dwight does. I use it in a different way and I don't use it to determine. I do, but I use it on a body count perspective. But
okay. Love it. So that's your number one. You're going to saying, hey, where is my fertile ground? Is that the farmer in you that says, like, how big is my crop? How big is my field to plant?
There you go.
I'm going to pluck from this and see what radishes were missed.
What he meant to say was, how many head of cattle is this ranch bringing me?
This is, yeah.
That's it.
What does it support? What does it support? How many do we have?
That's right.
So what do you define as an active, Trey, real quick?
Visited once within the past 18 months.
Okay, so 18. Dwight, 18?
Yeah.
Okay, same. Would love to see that as a 12 because I think
yes,
there's
I would too, but that's
I
not
I think
how
there's a, there's just significant friction from getting someone back after a year, but whatever. That's a pod for later. Okay, interesting. Body count, Trey. I can't I wish we could call it something else because I go to like
he's stuck.
I can't. I keep thinking like, what does he keep saying this?
So good. Active patients.
Dwight is so Trey's active patients. Dwight is utilization rate. And I am a little bit different as well. So this is good. I immediately go to percentage of hygiene, like I said. And so we all check that box. I think we all do that. And then I go to average production per patient visit. And the reason is, it's just kind of like both of you are saying, is that it's a quick metric for me. I always say, Dwight, that your metric defines, and I know you kind of champion that, your metric defines the efficiency of the facility. My metric defines the efficiency of the at-bat. Meaning, what did you do with said appointment, right? Did you enroll, under-enroll correctly, and whatever it is. And so the APPV, average production per patient visit, across the way, meaning that how many patients, and the easy math for that is the collections for the day and how many people came in the door divided by. Okay.
Yep.
And it gives you, to me, that's a nice barometer. I get that on the daily from every practice that is in my scope because it's a nice barometer of, or thermometer of how our health is from a phone perspective, from an enrollment perspective, from a diagnosis perspective. And now having years and years of data, I know that like if we dip down, then there's trouble, right? And then you kind of reverse engineer some of the metrics that got you there. Now, let me go back to the, on the acquisition perspective. If it's too low, if it's really low, meaning if it's in the $200 range or lower, it could be a good thing, meaning that there's a lot of dentistry to be done.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. If it's, for instance, like my practice, potentially, if I were to look at, if I didn't know anything about a practice like mine, you know, ours is probably in the, I think it's in the 840 range. And I would look at that and say, holy shit, that's, there's nothing, there's no dentistry to be done. If I didn't dig in, I'd say there's no dentistry to be done there. So to Dwight, back to your point about, I guess the example that you gave, that it might be a point of diminishing returns to integrate this, unless it was a quick bolt on from an enterprise level, right? If you were just trying to tuck it in as you were going to market. Yes. So obviously guys, I'm not trying to diminish our ability we don't have time for 100 things to go through. Obviously there's more than just that. I'm just trying to give a mindset shift into what maybe people could be thinking about if it wasn't on their radar, if they're in this market or thinking. And I think, look, remove the acquisition conversation, guys, just for a second. Wouldn't you agree that all the aforementioned things we said would make you a better operator in a solo practice?
Yes.
So the same skill set that we are talking about for expansion is actually behooves you to curate, even if you have no intentions of it.
Absolutely. Okay. And interestingly enough, every one of our answers speaks to where our strengths in our operational game is. And each one is an example of a utilization capacity of some sort.
Absolutely.
So it speaks to our strengths. It speaks to how we run and what we value in terms of what levers we pull.
You are so right, Trey. The end game is the same,
but it's all utilization capacity of some sort. It's efficiency.
You are so right. It really does speak to what we gravitate towards our strengths. And so true. So true. Okay. Let's move on to my cheat sheet here. So as we're going along, we've kind of identified some metrics and acquisition stuff. Okay. Let's talk about attrition just for a second, because I think this is underrepresented in acquisitions, at least in my world. I assume that, so what is attrition? We all know that it is people going out the back door. And I mean attrition in the context of both team and patients.
Yes.
And this is something that I think this is where people get their ass handed to them in acquisitions. Agree, disagree?
Oh, yeah. Number one.
Number one. Yeah. So what would you say is a high level, you're comfortable with the threshold of attrition from a patient-based perspective?
Of an acquisition.
Well, that's the only way it could be. No, not of your practice, Trey. No. Yep. Yeah, thank you. So Dr. Smith has had this practice for 20 years. Dr. Tippett buys it going forward. Day one to day 365, what would you expect would be a decent amount? You're like, you know what? That was in my threshold of my business plan. What would you guess? What would you say? And I know your grant, your body count and thing that, so give me a percentage of your body count.
So, I have always assumed that you're going to have roughly a 7% attrition from just people dying, moving, switching dentists, retiring, whatever. They don't like you, whatever the reasons people move on from the practices. And you're going to have a small amount from the idea of you come in and buy it. But at the same time, I'm not interested in attrition because I'm going to come in and put my systems in, which is going to stop it. So I assume that I'll always be better and we will increase attrition, which then increases the body count.
You're going to increase. Okay. You said increase attrition. So you're going to stop attrition. Okay. But
I don't have a threshold is what I'm really telling you. I don't have a threshold,
but you do. So you contend that you will have none as you acquire a practice.
No, you will have some, but it's minimal.
What he is saying is he might have 15% attrition, but he's doubling the number of new patients coming into that.
Got it. Okay.
So he doesn't care as much on the big picture.
So it's a cleansing process to a certain degree.
Oh, absolutely.
To some extent, but also keep in mind, let's say there's 15% attrition in the practice. When I come in, it is my intention to take that to 10. So it doesn't matter where it is. It matters where it's going to be. And that is why I don't have a threshold.
Okay. I meant not at the practice level meaning Dr. Smith, I'm not asking what Dr. Smith's attrition level is. I'm saying like, hey, the patient base doesn't like this conversion or new doc or whatever. Where I'm going, guys, I guess.
I project. I'm going to give it to you. I project around, I expect around, you know, calculate 15% attrition for an acquisition. If the perio percentage is super low, 10% or less, I expect it to go to 20%.
Interesting. Tell Dwight, say more.
So generally speaking, just because I'd like a nice conservative deal and I like my numbers to look good by 6 months in, I expect a 15% attrition of just the fact that change is hard for people. It just is. And we're talking active patients, by the way. And so my expectation obviously is to go in there and, like he says, decrease current attrition, but more importantly, increase the number of new patients coming in with branding and blah, blah, blah. But more importantly is when I analyzed the perio percentage of these practices and I realized that hygiene is doing bloody profies and all of a sudden the Fort Bend Dental brand is going to come in and everybody's cost to get a basic cleaning is going to go up because we're actually going to code for SRPs. We're actually going to diagnose periodontal disease. That seems to be the biggest contributor to attrition in practices anywhere else because they say, well, that's not what, even if the doctor's staying, FYI, even if the same doctor's staying, this is my biggest hit is I see a large attrition factor. And those aren't the kind of patients who we want to treat anyway.
So pause for 1 second, because I think this is so worthy of unpacking. So you like the fact that there's underdiagnosed hygiene going on because the population should be around 30%. Let's just call it, right? What's your goal? Is that your goal?
30 to 35%.
Okay. Correct. And we just know that's not facts. That's not overdiagnosis. That's just facts. That 35% of the United States population should be in some kind of periodontal therapy. Full stop. Right. Okay. We're all in agreement with that. So you're saying in Dr. Smith's scenario, where there was kind of just even super glass neglect going on for the past 20 years of bloody profies, mm-hmm. you're saying that you're going to have to do these conversations. Well, Dr. Smith didn't say anything and I've been going to him for 20 years and they never said anything about this periodontal condition.
Right.
Not to go too granular. How do you train your team to unwind that?
Well, this is also what causes the most team attrition too.
Okay.
So this is where I see the most attrition of hygienists and office leaders because nobody likes admitting to the fact that they haven't done it right for a long time. But the second they left hygiene school, they knew what an SRP was and a profi was. But then when they worked here for 10, 15 years, the doctor never diagnosed it. And their job was easier because they were paid the same amount per hour to just process it and make their patients happy and make them pay less, right? So that's the piece that hits, but you've got to come in and you know that that's going to happen. So do I have a certain conversation with the team and say, let's talk about periodontal disease and here's your pathway to bone loss / this and this. And I give them the whole pathway. And then I say, now our conversation with our patients is we now know that periodontal disease leads to blah, blah, blah.
You just stole my thunder. Damn it, Dwight.
I'm sorry, man.
Damn it.
And I have hung out for a long time.
Yeah. That's such a good game changer, right? Because what I think so many people do is, well, Dr. Smith was an idiot, right? Like kind of in a vein, like having to make someone else look bad to make you look better and smarter, right? I think so much. Maybe we don't do that anymore in dentistry, but I used to see it as kind of the Craig always says, the dental firing squad was a circle.
Right.
Did I say that?
Yeah.
But Dwight, that's amazing because it doesn't denigrate him by saying, right. Hey, well, what we know now in research is that X, right? Mm-hmm. I think is such the great.
And let me tell you why it's hard for team, right? Not just for patients, right? Mm. Patients comes in and they're saying, well, I've been going here for 10 years. Like, why? What changed? We now know. The other thing then is having an honest conversation with the team, because they always freak out because we come in and we're looking at numbers. The fact that we even know the perio percentage is sometimes too much for some high.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa.
Well, and I always tell them, I'm like, don't know it.
Yeah. It's like, let's stop. Let's stand on the scale in the morning. And by standing on the scale, we now know, oh, I put on some pounds. Should I go up the stairs or should I take the elevator? Should I have the French fries or should I have the hamburger or should I have the salad? We make decisions throughout our day to make sure we care for our patients completely, totally, comprehensively, and do it. But that's the piece. That's the attrition factor right there is, no, doc, what I don't want to tell you, the ones that leave are the ones who, what I really don't want to tell you when you're coming in is I really liked my easy job, where I could just polish the tops of teeth, get paid the same amount per hour, and just go home and not have to worry about hard conversations with patients about periodontal disease or any of that. My job was easy with the previous doctor, and now my job is hard. That creates attrition with the team and with the patient.
You know who taught me? I think maybe you picked that line up from me, or maybe, but I picked it up from Charissa, my hygienist, a long time ago. And maybe you came to the same conclusion, but I'm not endorsing one way or the other. I'm just saying I learned it from Charissa when I would hear her do that, getting out of like uncomfortable conversations, right? Because she's doing these thorough diagnoses. And well, the last practice I went to didn't say anything about this. And she's like, well, you know, it was just like beautiful verbiage. And I think verbiage can be an art form where it can, you know, it can really get you out of, yeah, whatever. I won't go into the whole verbiage, but it's very disarming when said the right way about like, oh, okay, this is to my benefit, you know, so to speak. You may have not been exposed to it, but welcome to a new experience, so to speak. Welcome to a new diagnosis. Welcome to new technology. Welcome to new science. Congratulations. Yeah. We're glad you're here. You know?
Yeah. It protects the integrity of all involved.
Yeah. And I started deploying that too when, you know, second opinions and things like that, people come in and, you know, it's like, well, you know, why this doc do this bridge? You know, well, what we know now is that, you know, he did a great job. But what we know now is this.
And
if you take nothing else away from this pod today,
write that down.
That's a good one. Have your team say what we know now, not they're idiots down the street.
It used to be a lot harder. I mean, now with technology, though, you can take images, you can take x-rays, you've got AI embedded on top of the x-rays. It's pointing out bone loss, it's pointing out decay.
Yeah, I didn't say it.
It's like, and the whole goal is to train the team, right? To where by the time the doctor comes in, because the doctor who's been there for 10, 15 years working on these patients with supervised neglect, they're walking into a very dangerous conversation and they don't want to deal with it.
Dwight, say that again. The whole goal is to have the team finish
the
team, that.
So the team runs the operations of the practice. And if the doctor drives it, you will always falter on your KPIs. You just will, because they put emotional factors into their relationship with their patients, which is great that they have a relationship with their patients, but then they can't charge them properly. They don't diagnose them properly. They don't do what's needed to be done.
So let me ask you a question. Would this be like apex level practice, meaning that the doctor gets to come in because he has trained his team on things to look for, things to do, verbiage, body language, psychology, all the things, right? Yeah. That he gets to come in and just say, yeah, Sally, the hygienist, that's spot on, amazing, and gets to do what I call the bobblehead. Mm-hmm. The less you can say, the better. I know people are paying for your expertise, but if you truly agree with it and you're getting your team to quote unquote co-diagnose, yes, I know they're not allowed to diagnose, I know, but if you're getting them to co-diagnose and everyone has this alignment, you just come in, your lift, like you said, Dwight, is super easy. You're not having to keep being the hero in the room every day, every hour, every appointment. You're not the hero. Right? Who comes to save the enrollment, so to speak. Correct. Your whole team is driving towards that. Well, we know we've been trained well. We know what to do. I sense that Mrs. Jones is uncomfortable right now. Let me back off. Let me sit her up while I'm talking to her. Let me make sure she's comfortable and where knows where the bathroom is. Like, it's the million things that add to all these things. And I know I just spit out a bunch of shit right there.
Well, let me summarize it. This is how I explain it to my doctors. Okay. So you go into a hygiene room. The hygienist has been with that patient for 45 minutes. And I look at all my doctors and I say, do not confuse your authority as a doctor with your competency. They are two very different things. Mm. And the truth is that person's been in that mouth has evaluated the periodontal disease, has AI on the screen, is telling it all. And if you dare go against that because you want to flex your authority as a doctor, you don't work here.
Wow.
And that's the mindset that we have to get to, because the truth is that there's no way that because I was in three other rooms doing an extraction, a prep, doing all these other things, and I'm going to walk in there and I'm the ultimate most competent person on knowing what's going on. I may know the treatment plan, but the diagnostic process is all in front of me and set in front of me. And if you train your team well, your patients will get the best care. But if I'm tired from running three chairs on the other side, that patient is not getting my comprehensive evaluation because of the fact that just by nature, I'm expecting to be a well-rounded, perfect individual doctor, owner, everything on my shoulders. And that's just not leadership.
You know, that's where we go over, like at the summit, we go over, like Sharice and I did it last year as a live demo, you know, is the trust transfer or the handoffs. And sure. I think that's where really you start learning how to do exactly what we're saying, right? Is the relying on the person who has the most context in that appointment to kind of lead it and then hand it off to you. And then you hand it back. And the patient feel that in the middle of that benefit circle, the patient feels the most benefit because they feel like they're being heard. They feel like there's a collaborative team around them. They're not just saying it. There's not arguments or whatever going on inside. It's even if you viciously disagree with your hygienist, never, never, never do it in person. Say, oh, that's great. I see that. Yeah, but we're not going to address that now. Right. Which means like you could mean like that's totally inaccurate. We're never going to address that. But you could say something like it's all verbiage because if you said, no, that's stupid. You're a hygienist. You shouldn't be diagnosing in front of a patient. Like, goodbye. Right. Shut it down. Correct. Close the doors and lock them.
Yeah. Yeah. You might as well focus on complimenting and appreciating your team for taking mm-hmm. a step out to look out for things and say, wow, I'm so glad you pointed that out to me. You know what we're going to do? We're going to put some other things in priority first, and then we're going to see how that works around and see if that continues to be a problem for her. Boom. But what I'm not going to do is create that, because I don't only lose a team member and a trusting team member. I also lose that patient most likely, because patients do not like it when teams fight more so than how the results.
Yeah. Are you kidding me? That's probably the most like, yeah, that's probably the biggest. We could spend a whole pot on this alone, but we can't. So we're done with that for a second. We're going back to our metrics for a second. Trey, Dwight, they get presented with their pipeline information. And now you're like, you know what? I'm going to make a run at this. What is your next move?
I like a letter of intent.
Okay. So LOI. Got it. Mm-hmm. Trey, same?
Same.
Got it. Okay, good. Would you say that an LOI is more serious, the same as an MOU, memorandum of understanding, or less serious?
It's less serious.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Non-binding. So you're just here are your intentions. Okay. So do you do that yourselves? Okay.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
If you had no way, let's say this was your first one. When you did your first one, let's just say that was on your benefit, did you do it? Did you have a lawyer do it? Did you have a broker do it? Did you just send an email? Tell me.
First one, I had a lawyer do it.
Okay.
Because I didn't know.
Right. Yeah. Perfect.
And now I usually have AI do it. I've got so many versions of it that it's fun.
Hey,
whatever.
I'm laughing not because I think that was a great answer, by the way. Yeah. And not the first version, of course, Dwight. And you and I actually we compared notes on our LOI and stuff like that. And I think both of them had. I think we both spun them through intelligent processors.
Yeah, and I like to get an LOI out of AI just because I don't want to have to type in all the names and say the general deal analysis and this and this. So I type in all that stuff. It spits that out. And then I take the chunks that I love from other LOIs that I have.
Can you pull up the one that I sent you or pull up yours so that quickly, because I can't do it on my screen. But what I want to go on is, Dwight, is just some constituents of some things. What are the components of things you want to potentially address? Because I contend, and I say this in life, that everything on the front end is very amenable. It's an explanation. It's so cool. No problem. Yeah, everyone's cool with it. But you get to the deal table and all of a sudden now you're like, oh, I forgot to mention. Oh, you know what? We're going to have to do this too. Everything else then becomes contentious and fighting. And now it sets it off in bad blood. So I guess my advice to everyone listening would be, you can't over explain your intentions, your letter of intent. And it's non-binding. Therefore, nothing you can do, nothing you can say is going to help hold you to that letter, right? LOIs are non-binding agreements. They are just gentlemen or gentlewoman's agreements that said, hey, I'd like to move forward with the practice. Let's do a deal. In the meantime, you need to take the practice off the market.
And I think that's the most important thing is when we say non-binding, meaning it's a legal contract that's non-binding, meaning it's not really a legal contract. It's, I agree, you agree. It's the closest thing that in law we have to what would be considered a handshake.
A handshake.
Yeah. Right? General handshake. Yeah.
Yeah.
A handshake with a lot of parameters, right? And that's a great way of doing it, right? We're not trying to come in the way of the Brian Kaleos in the world when you go to broker the practice. Like, get a real dental attorney. I totally agree. But also, you will save a lot of money by having a very comprehensive MOU or LOI. You will save a lot of money because it's no longer these back and forth. What do you want to do here? What do you want to do here? Here's the things we agreed to. Make it so.
Agreed.
Right? Okay, Dwight, are you able to pull it up or
I'm trying right now?
Yeah. It's
sorry, I was looking for that specific one because I think that last one we talked about was really good. Clean LOI, yeah.
So just generally, I guess for the audience, right? Like, it's not just hey, I'd like to buy your practice. Let's talk, kind of thing. It's a little bit more sophisticated, a little bit more. You want to show that you're a good operator.
I'm changing some stuff on here because this one has. The one you said.
No, you don't have to share a screen. You don't have to share a screen. Don't share a screen. I'm asking, just look at it and glance through and say, like, here's the components of it that have been mentioned. And you can just throw it out there.
Yeah. So set purchase price.
Okay.
From then it's.
So that's your offer. My offer is this. Okay.
Offer is this. Remaining in purchase price. So closing date. So time. Of a feasibility period. So essentially, how long are you and I going to take this handshake to figure out that we should be closing by this certain date?
Sure.
There's some.
What about in the purchase price, right? That's the place to also identify if there's any kind of installments, earnouts, owner financing, things like that. You want to declare that.
Correct.
On the front end. Okay.
So anything that would be like the total price is this, but we're going to break it down by paying in this amount and these installments.
Perfect.
And a percentage of which can be goodwill for tax purposes or what.
That is very important to identify because that becomes contentious because
sure does.
Because we sellers and buyers want different things.
It puts you at odds. It needs to be done on the front end.
In the LOI. Agreed.
Correct.
Okay. Dwight, any other components you see? The way that if the doctor is retained, if you're retaining the doctor, then obviously you'd want to talk about the collections and how they would stay on as an employee.
Doctor retention. And then the biggie for me is AR, whether you're taking on AR or whether it's being.
How long would you grant? Yeah, this is so good. How long would you grant the window in which they can it is their AR.
So I set it to closing date, but I'm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty strict.
Yeah. I say I buy AR. I'm willing to pay more for purchase to buy it to where day one.
Trey, what about you?
I used to avoid it. Now I buy it.
Okay. Yeah. So I don't buy it. And interesting, I give 90 days for it to come to fruition. After that, it's everything is mine for free. Everything that's not been collected in that is mine
usually,
at no cost.
Usually when I've come with a lower price amount than what they were asking, my expectation is they're going to say, no, we really want this. I said, okay, well, to get that, I need the AR at closing. That's just kind of
interesting.
What I do.
Okay.
So I buy it.
That's a good tactic.
That is a good tactic.
I give 6 months, 180 days instead of 90. I've given 90 in the past, but I give 6 months because I know I'm going to collect it in 90 and it's a red herring. I mean, it sounds a lot better.
Yep.
But then I charge 5%.
What else? What else in there, guys? Dwight, do you feel like is so worthy of man, this saved me by putting it in and talking about it on the front end.
Non-compete components.
Non-compete, right? Restrictive covenants and non-compete, especially if they're, you know, because that's important. Sometimes it's moot given the age and just some things, but like if you don't discuss it, it becomes an issue. What else?
Yeah. Any clawbacks that you want?
Clawbacks. Okay. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that a little bit?
So anything that would relate to the fact that, let's say, you know, come to find out that they were going to leave anyway, or that they have another, you know, practice affiliate, or anything that would reduce the value of the practice at its current state. So let's say the doctor is staying and all of a sudden the doctor's no longer producing what he previously produced because he's no longer the owner. It could be a clawback to the actual, you know, the remaining installments to be paid, or their total value of their exit or something to that degree.
Okay. Trey, anything else on that?
That covers all the basic point. There's some legalese in there, but I think those are the big ones.
Who's going to draft the APA?
The other things that I would talk about is deduct any equipment that fails in the time period of that earnout, right? So if I'm buying sound equipment, right, if you maintain things, if something fails in X amount of time, well, usually either the earnout time or let's just say 6 months. Give me a 6 month warranty on the equipment. Again, small, but it could be an indication of, oh shit, we have a lot of, if it's a contentious point, then there could be some neglect that someone knows about.
So the last two deals, I put that in, and that's really interesting because you taught me that. Mm-hmm. And it's been interesting. It's always been cut back, but there's always a piece of it that's left in there, which is great because something's going to go down. And, you know, I mean, it's just, it's a dental office. Something always goes
totally.
It also like, gives somebody something to focus on.
Correct.
Or just disclose that now. Like, hey, yeah, I'll do everything with the exception of we know that the compressor sucks, you know, or something. I don't know. And that's built in the price. And that's why we asked this. But like, again, just conversation. The other thing I would talk about is if we have to have salary increases due to retaining the team, right? That meaning if you have to sweeten the pot or salary renegotiations or whatever, like there needs to be attribution for that somehow, because that's going to affect the revenues, the EBITDA, the profit, the cash flow, all those things. Something to think about.
Although they normally increase the pay right before they take it to market.
But probably less than what you will, to be fair.
For sure.
Right. I think that covers it, guys.
Well, I think what's good about that is explaining that it's actually not a lot, because everybody thinks that in order to purchase a practice or get into a feasibility period, it's like you're drafting a whole asset purchase agreement, and that's not what we're doing, right? Like you are.
Yeah, it's not an APA.
Just like, hey, just tell them I'm interested in buying your business. That's it. Like, let's figure it out over 2 weeks or 2 months worth of time. Like, that's it. Keep it simple.
Got it. I think that's where, and I'm into simplicity and speed. I leave almost everything I can out except for the large components or something I want them to focus on so they win a negotiation. But okay. I want to move fast. So I'm trying to put it out, get it there, not tie it up with a little bit here.
Yeah, but the deal can blow up though, Trey, with not having clarity on something that's important to you and not them and vice versa.
Correct. So I make sure the big pieces are in.
Okay.
But I don't clutter.
So did we miss anything with that? I'm not saying that the MOU is not an APA or contract or anything like that. It's just, did we hit the big rocks?
Yeah.
How often would you use, just to help for the listener, would you use an MOU versus an LOI?
I think when it's, you could probably do both. You could say, here's our LOI and we redlined it. Now let's go to a memorandum of understanding of how we anticipate this going down. And then I would actually anticipate a little bit more detail, like the process of how it's going to go.
Cause I like to say, once you're starting to feel that you're going to incur costs,
that could be overkill, Dwight. Meaning at this level.
I usually just go LOI to APA. But yep. If I feel that I'm incurring costs to help you manage, for example, it's a merger deal or a larger acquisition, and I have to go and value your assets more, or I've got to go evaluate more, and I'm going to put in some investment into that, then the MOU comes in. But I haven't done those very often at all.
Hey, everybody. Let's hang out in Scottsdale, Arizona. Join Pete and me at the 2024 Bulletproof Summit at the beautiful JW Marriott Camelback in Scottsdale. Immerse yourself in innovation and inspiration. Unite and strengthen your team and earn 16 CE credits. That's June 14th and 15th. Register at bulletproofsummit.com. We can't wait to connect with you and your entire team. See you soon, guys.
Usually it's an LOI to the APA.
Yeah, I have not either.
I would never do an MOU outside of when you think about it, what Dwight just explained. If you start, instead of buying onesies and twosies, and you start to buy, you know, small groups.
Yeah.
Five to ten.
Because at that point in time, you're looking for fraud. That may be more important. Yeah, you're looking for fraud. You're actually revaluing their, you know, you're bringing somebody in to actually do an evaluation of their actual earnings. So all that is a lot more expensive and it incurs costs, and MOUs, you can claw back those costs if it doesn't close or it goes towards it or something to that degree. So.
Got it. So the next thing on my list, as we cross over the hour mark into this, is ironically, it's going to get a little bit more granular. And maybe we'll have to put this as part two or what.
Let's call Craig. He could help here.
Oh my God. It's going into what is called the due diligence. So Dwight, you said in that period of taking the practice off the market, you have a diligence period, no different than for example, the analogy to everyone, just to make it really simple, is if you were buying a house. You have a time period where inspection period and a banker period, and that's where your earnest money, you put down your earnest money and they give you 30 days to handle that stuff. Get the inspections, look in, pop the hood, check it all out, right? Yep. So that is your diligence period when buying a home. You have a diligence period when buying a practice that's a little longer, right? Because it's more than just buying a home. And I, you know, and not that there is a list of things to do. I think there's generalized, understood things that you should be doing, some of which are the KPIs in which we already spoke of, right?
Yes.
Right. So some of the preliminary work actually applies to later. You've kind of checked that box in your head as I don't need to know the patient census data because I know that there's X amount of patients. I've verified that, and that's what got me to the deal. Can you guys just throw out some things about a diligence perspective? And maybe this is being disrespectful to the process of just like, hey, do this shit. Maybe it should be more formalized and we should go down a list of things and make it comprehensive. I don't know. I'm looking for your feedback on the fly as we're sitting here recording live.
First thing I would just say, because everybody should better or just understand this a little better. The due diligence period is still non-patient facing and non-team facing.
Yes.
So, and a lot of people don't understand that. They think, I get to go, like you said, look under the hood or drive the car. Like, that's not the case either. You actually don't get to exposure because people don't want to disrupt their operations, and you don't want to either, because the second someone thinks they're going to buy, they think the doctor's going to leave. So that's the first thing I would say that everybody should understand.
Yep. Agreed. I'm going to just throw out some things just because for the sake of time, things that I have written down as, and I want you guys to either add to, agree, disagree. So we need to look at the census data. Like I just talked about the number of days open, the number of new patients, the number of existing patients, right? That is our census. Agreed. We all agree with that. Yes, we need to look at production versus collection, right? How much is there a discrepancy with our AR and what's going on there? We need to look at how many new patients are getting. What is the marketing percentage as a percentage of revenue? Is it zero? Is it 12? Right? These are big factors to look at. If it's zero, yay. And you've got, you know, and you like how the practice is performing and they've done $0 in marketing, like bonus, right?
Right.
I want to look at the payer mix, fee for service, insurance, Medicaid, you know, things like that. You want to look at where is the data for your recall or your retention, your data. Want me to stop? Agreed. Pause. Are we all in agreement?
No, that's good. That's
okay. I want to look at the office, just the information, the number of chairs, the real estate, the rents, the leases that are in place. You want to look at the income statement review that's been generated by the CPA and signed by that CPA.
Not the brokers.
Not the Do not look at the pro forma of here's the cute PDF that I'll send you.
What could
and
be?
With the extrapolations of if you buy it today, here's what it'll do in 4 years.
Ridiculous.
At the current run rate, right? And you're like, holy shit. You want to do, and here's where I think, Dwight, you said you can't really do this. Part of this has to happen later, but here's where I failed in my most recent acquisition is the employee review.
That's huge.
I just took it for face value of start date, salary, bonuses, 401, all that stuff, payroll software. I looked into that, but I guess what I didn't take it. I had to go back after post close and do negotiations of employees and new contract, because you have to set up new contracts because of a new entity and things like that. Yeah. And I should have made that been a prerequisite to the deal. So you learn something with every attrition.
That's one of the few things I think I've really been burned on, and it's because it's not intentional, but they fill out a pro forma of a practice, a broker's practice analysis type deal, and it's how much does this person make? X dollars per hour, and then they leave out bonuses, benefits. They leave all these things out that are well beyond just this dollar per hour thing. And then if you don't go ask and figure out those things, you go in thinking you're giving someone a raise, and they come in going, where's the bonus that he gives us every year? That's absurd. Yeah.
Well, that wasn't on my pro forma sheet. So you don't get it.
But the doctor paid for my health insurance on the side.
The doctor gave me cash for my car.
That's right.
So I'll add a couple things from my list that are pretty
great.
They're broad, but they're specific in terms of I want to know these things. First and foremost, I go in and I literally sit at their computer and I count how many hygiene visits they've had in 6 months. That gives me a fully accurate picture that I trust of their hygiene program, which I build everything off of the hygiene program. So that's the first and foremost due diligence I do. I have the IT evaluated and the equipment evaluated. That plus those salaries, and that's enough for me to feel comfortable.
Wow. That's IT a pretty quick diligence. That's awesome, Trey.
IT is huge, equipment as well. I mean, it changes the deal real fast.
Yeah, and so look, it's like I said before, this isn't a comprehensive list where you have to check it off with all, but at least it, like, no one ever told me. I guess when I started this pod is like, I wish I just heard someone say like, hey, here's some ideas of things you would look at, as opposed to just like, well, go do your due diligence. Like, everyone just throws around that word like you should know what it is. It's ridiculous. I wish someone just given a list of like, oh, cool, anyway. So IT, Dwight, you said is huge. You want to look at what the marketing and what they're doing for marketing, right? Because then you either see your upside, not upside, whatever. Clinical stuff. Obviously, there's a clinical review where you want to kind of do a chart audit. You want to make sure there's certifications and licenses and all that thing is all kind of in place. And that's kind of, that would, there's some other little things, but I think that's the big scope of what I would consider pretty good due diligence.
That's really good.
Good. Good. Okay. Moving on. We've kind of a lot of big things. So what I want to do is put a pin in this and want to continue it later of things that you would perform kind of before closing, right before closing, and things that you would want to do right after closing. And maybe it's not even specific things like change the locks. Maybe it's not that, but would you guys agree? Actually, we can button it up with this kind of one statement. What would you guys agree to do day one?
You better have all the financial, as in, and by financial, I mean bank accounts.
Account.
Yep. You better have your merchant processing. You better be able to collect money day one.
Yep. Everything else, I've heard the advice of people who've done this as their job, and they have learned that Trey, exactly. You got to get the money going in the right place, right? The new accounts, your processing has to be set up. Like that's for sure has to be done day one. But after that, I have been told that if you can kind of, because what people are expecting, the team is expecting, I'm waiting for the shoe to drop, right? Oh, waiting for them to change everything and tell me I'm getting a pay cut. Tell me we're changing the software. Tell me that we're doing this. Tell me what they're doing that. If you're looking for retention, so do you see where I'm going with that?
Yeah.
I've been advised that if you can phase things over 6 months, great. Do that. Right. As long as revenues can maintain where you are, you want to just go in and don't make these big draconian moves all at once. You want to earn the trust of the team. You want to show them the team benefited verbiage. You know, like I went in recently a couple of weeks ago and said to the team, like, look, my intention, and I looked all of them in the eyeballs and said, my intention is to make your life better, not worse. Right. Whatever that means. That means I'm not trying to take things away or do this what, or trick you guys or do that. My intention is that I hope I can make your life better. And the doctor who stayed on was sitting right there. And I was like, and no, I'm not giving any disparagement. I just hope to do things a little bit better and you guys get to benefit because of that.
That's right.
You know,
I love that. I love that mindset. We call as the snowplow team. So the integration team is like, we come in, we're snowplow. Our job is to make it all easier, get everything out of the way for you. But you're right. Don't do it in the first 3 weeks, in the first month. Like, it is too destructive and you will lose.
Trey disagrees.
No, I'm laughing because he calls it a snowplow team and I have the exact same team called the Tres Amigas. So it's just random fucking more, names Trey's for these people coming in.
You're more Texas than I am, I guess.
So, yeah. And if you guys, I was going to make a snowflake versus snowplow joke, but I can't. I don't even have it. I didn't want to offend people.
Too late. I already made it.
All right. Well, there you go. Draw your own jokes from that. The snowplow team and the Tres Amigos. So those are your integrators. The fact that you guys have a team devoted to integration means that we are not the same. You and I.
Why did I know you were going to say that?
But I'm giving you a compliment. Like, we are not the same.
Yeah, that is the ticket to speed.
Yeah, but here's the deal, Trey. There is an inflection point where that you cannot do that. Like, look, if you know, burn the boats. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm acquiring. Blah blah blah. My inbox is crowded. My inbound is just so full of brokers and blah, blah, blah. And people wanting me to buy their practice. And you want to make an investment that potentially could blow up in your face, right? Because you're bringing them on with the only job focus of integrating the acquisitions that you have approved.
Correct.
Yes. Yes. Can't you see how that would be scary for us mere mortals?
No.
As Craig would say, well, what's your vision?
Yeah, well.
The idea, though, is everything is...
Sometimes
my
vision point is not to be broke.
So the idea of it is it actually improves speed and actually onboards better because it is done at a very controlled, a very processed...
But Trey, it's not... I completely agree with you. Hey, I'm not battling y'all's logic. I'm very proud of y'all. What I'm battling is... I think, Dwight, you nailed it, is that, like, it's not... You do not need an integration team if you're going to do one acquisition in your life, right?
100%.
Right.
Yes,
you, 100%. If this is going to become your identity as the mad acquirer, then yeah, you need to build, like Dwight, you have built infrastructure. Like I always say, build for the practice you want, not for the practice you have. Hire for the practice you want, not for the practice you have. And Dwight, you built an operational center, a headquarters offsite of your stuff because you knew, you know, your destiny was this kind of thing, right? Yeah. Trey, you kind of came into this, I feel like lately, in the past 3 years, you've been developing velocity towards this, and you've gotten some clarity on, like, wow, this is my life's arbitrage, if you will, right? Like, this is where you're uniquely qualified, and you gravitated towards your strength, and you're like, man, I'm really good at this. I enjoy this, and I'm getting a lot of fulfillment. Therefore, go. My point of saying that is I don't want people to understand all these things we're saying and think that they've got to nail it the first time, or they've got to fully have their vision, because visions change, as we know. And there is an inflection point that you guys have clarity in. It's like, oh, integrations teams are highly the thing to do. But someone could hear that and say, well, I don't have an integrations team. And guess what? Totally I don't have an integrations team. I have an integration person who helps me.
You have a person. You have a very good person.
Yes, you are right.
Who's not tethered to the existing operation so much that she cannot go and integrate, which essentially is
yeah. There's some bandwidth built in, right? That I have accounted for. Yeah, you're right. I don't know. And look at scale. Obviously, every DSO, mid-level DSO, you know, has an integrations team. It's that important, where it's not just bolt them on. You actually have to centralize, find the economies of scale, retain the culture, retain the people, go through the diligence, all these things we spoke about. And so that's why it's hard to go from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 practices, right? Before you have the team is the hardest, most glass eating time there is.
The idea, that's for sure. The idea is you need it to be systematic. Whatever that system may be, one person, a team of people, you, but if you're going to scale it, you better start developing that system and you better start being intentional with that system.
How many times have you guys done something thinking you weren't going to need to do it again, whatever it is? I'm not talking about acquiring practices, and then you get to the end. You're like, damn, I should have documented that in some capacity.
No, all the time, dude. All the time.
All the time I do that. I'm like, why didn't I not just spitball and write this down? And then I do it again and again and again. And by the fifth, sixth time, I'm like, maybe I'll write it down this time. You know,
that's why iteration is the game. Cause by the 100th time you do it, you're like, man, I might be good at this.
Yeah. But like, if only Trey, you had a mentor in your ass, is like, don't get the ass kicking that I got, right? Just do it this way. Just freaking trust me.
I agree. But let me frame that a different way too. By doing things, by going at it yourself, hitting the roadblock, finding the way around, the level of learning that you do and the level that it sinks in is pretty staggering. So I do agree with you. It's better to not jump in the fire to know it's hot. But at the same time, some fires you need to jump in.
Yeah, there's sometimes a baptism by fire. Yeah, you kind of have to. Yeah, there's no way you're gonna engineer your way out of an ass kicking.
Correct. And then I think it's the best said is what you just said. It's a baptism by fire. You are going to be baptized and it's going
to
be by fire.
But like, look, that I think applies to as we kind of wrap this up, right? I think we will all agree that as dentists, we are very risk averse. And I think of dentists, we are probably the outliers in liking some of the risk. But our profession is very risk averse, meaning, and you'll hear people say, well, I'm a perfectionist, therefore I don't want to do it. When people say that, usually it's an excuse for not taking action.
Correct.
Just so we're all crystal clear.
Yeah, okay. It's poor leadership. It goes back to what
I'm a perfectionist. No, you're not. You're just too chicken shit to move.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's what we said. It's someone thinking that authority and competency is in the same category. And it's not. You need to get out of the way and then create a team. You know what your strengths are. Like, maximally exploit those.
But I think where I was going with that, though, Dwight, is that just understanding that there will be pain and there will be glory times and there will be dark times, but like, until you're the man in the arena or the woman in the arena, like there's no SOP that you're going to download from Bulletproof that's going to save you the brain damage. There's some that may push you along and let you skip some of the landmines. There's, you know, having a mentor may help you skip some of those landmines. But I guess my example, Trey, back to you, is why didn't we get a mentor that helped you do it? Is that you're right. And you get in the arena, you're going to get stuck by the bull a couple times, regardless. I don't care how good of a bullfighter you are, right? I don't know why I keep going with these metaphors, but whatever. You guys get it. Is that there's no amount of preparation is going to escape you from an ass kicking. You're just trying to lessen that amount of ass kicking. All right. And learn very, very quickly, Trey, from your mistakes, because that is the accelerated learning that is going to help you with the muscle you're going to build is going to help you with the next one. Yeah, that's so true, right? Because every time, Trey, Dwight, have you guys, the most recent transactions you did, were they flawless?
Never.
Ever. Did you get your ass kicked and say, God dang, why didn't I learn this yet? Yeah. So did I. I thought, man, I almost beat myself up. Like, I'm better than this, aren't I? Like, and there's no such thing as the perfected deal or the perfected process or the perfected, why are we still learning this? You know, haven't we evolved past this? It's like a constant virtuous cycle of just.
But that's what makes us better. The fact that, you know, we're not content and purely happy, right? Like, happiness is equal to what? Like, reality minus expectations. All of a sudden we realize everything's changed, everything's different. But that sense of like, oh my gosh, every time right before Peter closes on a deal, he's like, he talks to one of us and he's like, hey, well, I'm like, I love that you're in that place.
My adrenaline's running a little bit. I'm a little clenched up right here.
Guess what? You know what that means? Is he's in his most strategic.
You did say that to me, actually. I think maybe you or Trey.
It was me at the
very last moment. I was like, man, I don't know. And you're like, the fact that you feel that way means it's a go. And I was like,
absolutely. Because that's how your brain is ready to strategize and fix. And that's the best time. I was most strategic during COVID, man.
I got to tell you, I don't know if this was a self-serving podcast. I don't know if someone got some value from it. I don't know if it was too grainy or too deep, whatever. But I got to tell you, like, I really like some of these sometimes where you're in there just turning that wrench, right? And just talking about it. And I was going to keep going into, I don't know if this doesn't need to be a part two. I think we evolved this into different kind of things because I think we might be losing some people on the specificity of it, but I think it's great. And I love chatting with you guys. I really do. I just want to say that.
We're all doing it differently. And that's what's great about it is we can. And I think there's a lot of parallels, but there's also little nuances in there. So always a good topic.
Anything else, Trey?
No, I think although we did get, you know, when you start talking about scale in this podcast, this is also a very good topic to always remember that the basic nuts and bolts of this apply to one single acquisition as well. So,
or no acquisitions almost.
Or no, yeah, that's right? A great point.
Make yourself
that's a great
meaning
point.
It's the same ground game, just making it better inside your current environment or in the new one. Yeah, yeah.
You
so it's a muscle that you get to develop and use. Regardless of where you are. All right, everybody. Hope you enjoyed it. We will see you next time. Thanks.
Later.
See you guys.